You're listening to Women Leading Prevention Science, where we host candid conversations with some of the most accomplished women in the prevention science field. I'm Sarah Hargrove, a public health analyst at RTI International and a master's in public health student at the University of Maryland. As I move through my early years as a prevention scientist, it's an honor to speak with these inspiring female leaders in the field. This podcast was developed as part of the NIH Helping End Addiction Long-Term Initiative, or the HEAL Prevention Cooperative. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and not the official views of NIH, the NIH HEAL Initiative, NIDA, or the participating institutions and organizations. Today, I'll be talking with Dr. Sarah Steverman about her career journey that led her to contributing to prevention science from a position in the federal government with the National Institute on Drug Abuse, or NIDA. NIDA's mission is to advance science on the causes and consequences of drug use and use disorders, and to apply that knowledge to improve individual and public health. Thank you so much for joining me today, Sarah. Would you mind introducing yourself and your current work?
I work at NIDA, at the National Institute on Drug Abuse, in the Prevention Research Branch. I'm also a project officer. I cover portfolios in healthcare and in policy, so research related to preventing substance use in healthcare settings and in using policy or systems level interventions. And then I also serve as a project scientist on three HEAL prevention studies. And I also am a project scientist on a couple other initiatives as well.
What's a day in the life of a NIDA project scientist?
We spend a lot of time in meetings, writing, reading, learning about what our grantees are up to, what they're interested in pursuing next, and spend quite a bit of time talking to applicants or potential applicants who are interested in sending us an application related to prevention. And that's actually one of my favorite parts of this job, mm-hmm. is speaking with investigators, learning about their research, learning about their ideas, and trying to align NIDA priorities and HEAL priorities with kind of what we're, what they're interested in doing and what their skill sets are. Another part of the NIDA program role is supporting grantees who are eligible for funding and those who have grants with NIDA. So when applications come into the Institute, we track their review once they come in, and then we shepherd them through funding decisions. And then once funded, a main function of this role is monitoring their study progress and offering support along the way for their studies. And as project scientist on HEAL, I'm able to take an even more active role as a collaborator on projects. I'm able to meet regularly with the HEAL study teams, weigh in on study decisions, and even on occasion present and publish with the research teams to try to get out the HEAL science that we're supporting. And then lastly, a large part of the program role and where I spend quite a bit of time is keeping up generally with the prevention field, with our science and what's going on in other parts of the federal government related to prevention, and also what's going on with prevention at state and local levels as well. So we're trying to do our part to find opportunities to move our NIDA science into practice, and support implementation at different levels of the government. So this often involves working with federal partners and external stakeholders to identify those opportunities to improve the system, opportunities to support evidence-based decision-making, evidence-based policy-making, and to take advantage of opportunities for interventions that we know work to ensure that they are being implemented in the field.
Sarah shared that in some ways she's had a bit of a meandering career and one that was less traditional. Her different experiences really helped her focus in on the type of work she wanted to do, even if it took her a little longer to get to where she is today.
It is quite different from a lot of the researchers that we work with who are in academia. I did take a circuitous route to federal government, and even a little bit of a circuitous route to my PhD. So when I was a religion major in college, and I majored in religion because I thought it was interesting, and I had no plan whatsoever what I was going to do with it. And so I got out of undergrad and I worked for a few years in community mental health in DC. I worked with adults with serious mental illness and co-occurring substance use disorder, most of whom had pretty significant social determinants of health that were impacting their mental health and their overall health. And then I decided I should get my master's in social work because that seemed like a good next step to be better equipped to work with populations and address issues related to systemic issues and individual issues related to mental health and substance use. So I got my MSW, and in that process realized I do not want to be a therapist. I didn't want to become a licensed social worker. And I went the policy route. So I worked with state legislators, working on mental health state level policy, and then moved into advocacy. So I was really working with states and state level advocates to try to improve mental health and substance use systems, and learning a lot about financing. And the overall kind of theme that I was seeing and understanding was that we were sort of putting Band-Aids on these problems. And so I really was sort of thinking about, like, how do we get ahead of this, which obviously brings us to prevention. And so I went back and got my PhD while I worked. So I didn't go kind of a more traditional route. I was working, I had a mortgage that I needed to pay. And so I had a job and I worked, went to school at night, or in the afternoon, evening, and I worked all weekend, to get my PhD done. I finished my PhD and was, making lots of decisions based on personal preferences of being in DC, finances, as I mentioned, like needing to pay my mortgage, having a mortgage and wanting to live in the home that I owned in DC. And so I chose my PhD program largely based on that and having a life here in DC, as opposed to kind of the research that I might be able to do in a PhD program. I learned the basics of research, but certainly did not have a lot of the opportunities that many more traditional PhD students would have, where they are part of a lab, and then moving into potentially a postdoc position where you are just, nose down doing research with a mentor. So then after graduating with my PhD, I was sort of in the process of moving with my spouse and having a baby. And I eventually ended up at SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, where I worked on contracts related to financing and prevention. I was able to get into the federal government and really see how a lot of the decisions around state level grant making, community level grant making, as well as policy level decision making happens kind of in the ground. And then I needed to move again for my partner's job, for my spouse's job. And I moved to a position where I could be mobile, which was with a contractor doing research and a lot of qualitative research and a lot of policy analysis, as well as some evidence review work, looking at evidence-based practices. And I was the project director for the Evidence-Based Practice Resource Center housed at SAMHSA, where we were really looking across myriad mental health and substance use issues related to evidence-based practices and trying to really translate the research to the field. I have a passion that has been developed over all of these positions to try to figure out how do we get this research that NIH is funding, largely funding, and getting that out to the field. And that was an opportunity to do that. And I came from there to NIDA with an interest in really kind of better understanding and better supporting the research. So I have from practice to advocacy for funding for the research to the policy and the state level grant making and the federal level grant making to, kind of translation of that research and then all the way back to the research.
I really appreciate hearing your story as an early career professional who's also working full time through grad school and figuring out, what's next.
I think that my path and being a generalist in the way that I am and having had these different experiences and working in these different sectors from direct service to advocacy to nonpartisan, you know, working with state legislators and really need to be nonpartisan and really being relying on the evidence to speak to legislators about what policies might work best, to, you know, navigating the system within the federal government, being a contractor where you have, you know, the sort of those dynamics of an understanding as a contractor, a lot of what, you know, applicants have to deal with as far as being responsive to the federal government and not quite knowing what the federal government wants. Like, I think all of those experiences has led me to a place where I am not the person to come to if you have a question about your effect size or statistical design. Like, I just haven't, you know, I can't answer that question. What I think is really fun about this position is that it does draw on a lot of the experience that I have and a lot of the knowledge that I have and the kind of perspective, I guess, that I have from kind of understanding these various levels of decision making and these various stakeholders and experts kind of throughout our field.
It sounds like you really gained that from, again, working at from every different angle. You're able to now build that kind of wider view of what's going on and with the financing and the policies and everything. You can look at the actual state of things and see how that impacts your grantees.
The order that I did things in was not necessarily linear or logical. You know, and a lot of the decisions I made were really based on external, you know, decisions as far as where I wanted to work and life circumstances and finances and things like that. And that's fine. There's no right way to do this.
SARA wants every community to have the resources to ensure that parents and children are healthy and have the best outcomes possible. This desire, coupled with her experiences as a partner and a mother, motivate her to do prevention science.
I think it goes back to this sort of bigger picture, more generalist feeling is just that we can really get ahead of these problems and thinking about, you know, kids now who can have healthy lives in the future. I think, you know, some of the first prevention research that I read was the Nurse Family Partnership, David Olds's, you know, decades long studies on nurse family partnership. And it just makes so much sense to set up kids and young parents with the resources to build a healthy life for their kids. And I think now that I am a parent and that I'm a parent that has parented through a pandemic, like I understand even better those early nurse family partnership studies, because I just like, I know what it's like to be in a, healthy and safe home with a small child and how hard it is. And so thinking about being in a home that is in a neighborhood that's not necessarily safe and that has food insecurity and financial insecurity is just, you know, I understand how those parents and those kids can have more difficult and worse outcomes than, you know, my kids. I'm a white parent of white kids and I have resources and I have a partner and I, you know, don't experience violence on a regular basis and it's hard. And so, you know, when you are experiencing this from a position of a lot of inequity and you know, where you don't have the resources that I have, like I can understand how we need to prepare our communities, we need to prepare our kids, we need to prepare, you know, in these very basic ways of giving, you know, as I see it, kind of basic rights of health and homes and financial security. That's like sort of the basis of this, of creating healthy communities and healthy homes and healthy kids and healthy parents and healthy people, healthy adults.
SARA offered important advice for young women aspiring to work in the prevention field or in prevention for the federal government. She suggests that young women talk to people about their careers, and she wants them to know that you don't have to have a PhD to do meaningful prevention science that you're passionate about.
I have always been someone who loves to talk about careers and options. And I think most people are that way. I had a MSW internship at SAMHSA. My supervisor is now retired from SAMHSA, but David Morissette, he was a really great mentor. And he told me, you know, people love to talk about themselves and people love to talk about their work, especially when they're doing work that, you know, is mission driven and is, you know, in the weeds and is, you know, on a topic that you also care about. So I thought that was really great advice that, you know, having the opportunity to just to meet with people, and most people are not so busy that they can't take a half an hour or an hour to speak with someone. And so I think if you are, you know, sort of unsure about where you want to go or what you want to do, reaching out and trying to talk to someone is one way to do that. I'm sure that maybe not every field is this way, but I think prevention science and in general, mental health, substance use, you know, health equity related folks are, you know, are just, it's good people, I think, who want to help and want to be collaborative and want to be supportive of more junior folks. I think reaching out on LinkedIn or like looking on websites of organizations that you're interested in and being bold and reaching out to people. And it really is not, I don't know anybody who is going to not answer your email if they are able to open it and read it and speak to you or to pass you to somebody who is more appropriate as well. You know, I'm always happy to have someone referred to me that I should speak to. I'll also say that you don't have to have a PhD in order to work and have meaningful work in government by any means. And so, or in basically any of the settings that I have worked in, there's a lot of folks with bachelor's and master's degrees that are doing really meaningful work and have really great experience. And there's also something really, you know, as someone who's getting to be a little bit more getting on in my career a little bit, you know, I love working with people who are younger and have a different backgrounds and different experiences. And there's almost nothing I like more than supporting people who are excited about the field and so and you know excited about their work and so I really and that there are different ways to go about making decisions. And I was working with a former colleague who was deciding where to go for their master's in public health and talking through, you know, all of these different options that they had and really trying to ask them what they felt like the right vibe was. I mean, it was, you know, this person was at a point in their life where they were, you know, really trying to establish community where they are in Boston and decided to stay in Boston and not go to more, you know, kind of prestigious, potentially, not that there aren't very great public health schools in Boston, I'm not saying that, but, you know, that they had so many options. And I think that there's just not always taking the most, I think it's important to not always take the most competitive or seemingly most prestigious decision. And so that may mean for someone not getting their PhD. And that may mean for someone not taking the postdoc. And I think those are all really valid, valid ways to go.
I think that's a really important consideration. Just that layer where we're also people, we're not just employees, or we're not just students. And sometimes you do have to prioritize those other aspects of your life.
And a recognition that there are really like great opportunities and great people and great experiences at all different levels and all different spots, you know, that goes, I think, for our feeling about applicants too, who, you know, I love when an applicant is coming from a, from an institution that hasn't had a lot of NIH funding. I mean, that is just really, you know, we need diversity. We need people who have different life experiences. We need people who, you know, understand communities that we want to impact. And so, you know, that's not always going to be sort of this more traditional, people coming from this more traditional process through academia and into government, even necessarily. You know, that those roots can really bring a lot of really good people and good experiences to our work when we have diversity within our ranks.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. And thank you to our listeners for joining us for Women Leading Prevention Science. We hope you enjoyed this episode and that you'll continue to join us as we host candid conversations with some of the most accomplished women in the prevention science field. We hope you'll share this podcast with your prevention science colleagues and with any young women you know that may be interested in pursuing a career in science. The HEAL Prevention Cooperative is funded through the NIH HEAL Initiative, an aggressive effort to speed scientific solutions to curb the national opioid public health crisis. The HEAL Prevention Cooperative includes 10 research projects throughout the country and one coordinating center based at RTI International in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. For more information on the NIH HEAL Initiative, please visit heal.nih.gov.